Now it's my delight to turn our attention to this evening, where we are here to discuss the lives of saints, ancient and modern. And our saint for this evening, of course, is both scandalous and sanctified, and that is our vicar, Louise Peters. So you'll see the scandalous side of her when you see her running around the office from photocopier to photocopier to photocopier wearing a tiara. And this was quite the scandal here at St. James. Everyone was confused, what's going on? But it was because it was her special hat, so that when you saw her wearing her tiara, you weren't allowed to talk to her, because it meant she was planning Bishop Aspel's consecration service. So she'd wear this tiara when it meant she was in the zone and you weren't allowed to talk to her. So that was her scandal. And then her experience of sanctity is that she's often seen floating above her stall in the pew in the cathedral as she celebrates Mass. She just floats and hovers because her angelic voice just helps us to transcend time and space. So please join me in welcoming our saint for the evening.
Goodness. Thank you, Lee, and thank you, friends, for the warm welcome. I do not have a doctorate. I am not royalty. I am a simple vicar, and I'm thrilled to be here and to share in this evening's conversation in this series of saints, ancient and modern. So I need to begin at the outset by confessing my ineptitude around technology, just so you know that. I will do my best to make sure that you can continue to hear me. I'll use the microphone, but I have some slides. There's not a lot of them. You can tell how pathetic my ability is as we go through them, but it's up and running, and so it'll happen. We are influenced by one another. Our lives are molded and shaped by our parents, our teachers, our social network of friends and families. And these circles that have the most influence are those that shape us. We are also influenced by those outside of those relational circles, leaders, celebrities, thinkers, famous ones. We are influenced by people who either offend us by their deeds or actions. And unfortunately, there's a fair bit of that happening currently, or who inspire, motivate, and transform us by their lives and deeds and thoughts, which hold the capacity for us to make ourselves into larger souls, encourage us to perhaps be more virtuous, or find courage, or perhaps live holy lives. That is why we want and why we need heroes. We want people whose lives seem to us to be larger than life, and yet are fully human and fully good, kind, and have an ability to live in such a way that those around them are attended to and safe. We as human beings are fascinated by the stories of other people's lives. Who here loves to read biographies? We find them fascinating to hear stories about another's life and to really get into the in-depth and the story of their history and what helped shape and form them. Biographies and tabloids, which is another way of hearing about people's lives, attest to our fascination with others. And these either help us to either see a reflection of ourselves and what we aspire to become, or they disgust us and hold up a caricature of what we never want to be. We are tickled by the fickleness of celebrity and the shamefulness of certain behaviors. We also find sometimes it's very satisfying to villainize. We like the gossip of it all. It is, for some, for many, for most, a form of entertainment. The cult of celebrity can indeed be quite entertaining indeed. But for us as Christians, there is another way. We have a long, rich tradition called the cult of the saints. It is a perspective that looks at the stories of those who have lived holy lives, and to look at them so that they indeed give us something to which to aspire, and something that can inspire. We are invited into a way that looks at the lives of others as a way to be possibly influenced, improved, and deepened in our gifts, virtues, faith, and living. We look at the lives of holy men and women. We tell their stories to be inspired by their examples, and not only do we explore, study, and tell stories about the saints because they lived, past tense of heroic spiritual import, but also because we believe that they are living and present with us now. They have present heroic import because we believe that we are a living community who prays together, the living and the dead, those who've gone before us. They present now journey with us as we walk together on this road to salvation, wherever it is that God is leading us. It's that cloud of witnesses spoken of in Hebrews. A community of those who have gone before us, who are with us now, who continue to inspire, encourage, support our faith. And yes, we can be entertained by them, just as we are indeed entertained by angels. We can be inspired and changed, one hopes. Tonight, in the final of our series on scandalous sanctity, I have chosen two saints, one ancient, one modern, as instructed, to spend time with so that we might be intrigued by their lives and witness, and hopefully thus also inspired and perhaps changed, and maybe entertained a bit. Because entertainment can be a way of transformation. That's why we tell stories, and that's why we are nosy and want to know more. So to begin, I start with Margaret of Scotland. And I need to, Margaret of Scotland, and Jean Vanier is the modern choice. And so a couple things before I dive in with Margaret. My Scottish is terrible, and my French is worse. So I apologize for all and many of the mispronunciations that you're going to hear this evening. I also need to acknowledge that my information is sourced from a variety of places, the Oxford Book of Saints, the important piece of work done by our colleague Stephen Reynolds, an Anglican, a Canadian, for All the Saints, biography by Spinks about Vanier, and various other online sources, web pages about L'Arche and Vanier, and a number of other sources. So I just need to acknowledge them. There, of course, is a multitude of resources about Vanier. There's all of the books that he himself has written and many that have been written about him. There is much less about Margaret. But I will try to keep things balanced and with our time limitations. Because of the time limitations, this has to be a high-level kind of focus on the two lives of these extraordinary people. And I hope to zone in on a few areas of commonality between them and how their lives, their witness, their faith poses for us questions in our own to reflect upon. I also need to acknowledge that language and words are going to be used in this lecture, and acknowledge, of course they are because it's a lecture, but to acknowledge that language and words change, are constantly a living unfolding of meaning. They change in their usage and their understanding. And context, of course, is shaped by language. So tonight you will hear reference to words and language that are contextual to the time in which they were written or spoken. I need to put that right out there because there are examples to be aware of and not to be offended by because I won't retranslate all of them. So words such as, you will hear mentally handicapped. Whereas today we prefer to refer to things to that as intellectual disability or differently abled. Or as was beautifully prayed this evening, what was your word you used tonight, Lee? Exceptionality, you know, just this whole loveliness of how our language is progressing. Another word that may have some trigger for you or different meaning is the word poor, and we're going to unpack that at the end of the lecture a bit. What was meant in the 1050s is quite different from what it means now. So just a forewarn that the language used or referenced is contextual and fluid, and sometimes I will translate it and sometimes I will not. Good. My first show off of PowerPoint. There she is. There's Margaret. Woohoo! Margaret, born 1046, died 1093. So let me tell you a bit of story about Margaret's life, a bit of her history. Margaret was a British princess, the daughter of Edward of Edling. Edward was exiled to Hungary because of the rule of Danish kings in England. Margaret took her education in Hungary, and her family returned briefly to England, but after the Norman conquest of 1066, she and her family took refuge in Scotland, in the court of Malcolm III, who was then the King of Scotland. Margaret was beautiful, she was highly intelligent, and she was a devout Roman Catholic Christian. She married the King of Scotland in 1069, and together they had 8 children. And it was her influence as queen, especially her influence on her spouse and the court as a woman of faith, that was the source of dramatic and significant change in the social fabric of Scotland and in the lives of her people. Margaret was able to restore and improve the lives and the settling of her country through her generosity and compassion, through her position of royal influence. But all of this was, of course, because of her deep, profound, and living faith. Her biographer, Turgot, the prior of Durham, the bishop of St. Andrews, is her primary biographer and was her friend and companion and spiritual advisor. In his account of her life, he stresses that Margaret's achievement, both in public and private life, were accomplished because, to quote him, Christ truly dwelt in her heart. So some of her public achievements. The Scottish court improved in its civility and its reputation among other countries because of her presence and her influence. It vaulted because she provided, in her presence and in her influence with her husband, a civility and a way of relating to others that lifted the court and how it related to one another in such a way that that improved negotiations with other countries. Margaret had significant influence upon the reforms of the Church of Scotland, which at the time in which she was there as queen was at a low ebb. She took a prominent part in the foundation of many monasteries, churches, and the hostels for pilgrims. She revived the abbey at Iona, and she built in, Angela, I'm going to need your help with the pronunciation of this one, Dunfermline. She built there what was to be like a Scottish Westminster Abbey as a burial place for the royal families. It has been noted that in areas of both political and religious arenas, Margaret's influence was highly English, and for all of those of you who are Scottish, you know that that can be problematic, that there continues, as there was from a very long time and long history, some challenge between the English and the Scottish, which makes her achievements to be both highly praised and highly criticized. Frayed English and Scottish relationships are felt to this day. However, Margaret, in her deeply devoted prayer life and practice, was able to hold deep sway with her husband and with the court, implementing changes in the lives of the people of Scotland and in her homeland. Her biographer says this about her. Her private life was devoted to prayer and readings and lavish almsgiving, including the liberation of Anglo-Saxon captives. She was also deeply devoted to ecclesiastical needlework. And her influence over the king was considerable. The king is described by her biographer as roughly, as being quite rough around the edges and rough in nature. He came through his love of Margaret to value what she valued. In seeing Christ in her, he came to reject what she rejected, to love what she loved, because of his love for her. He credits Margaret with civilizing the influence on Malcolm by reading him narratives from the Bible. He was illiterate. She would read to him stories from the Bible, especially stories from the Gospels. She also instigated significant religious reform in the country, striving to conform worship practices in Scotland to be more like those that were a wee bit more civilized, like those considered to be civilized in the Roman tradition. She did this through great inspiration and commitment, and also was allowed to make significant changes in the ferryways in Scotland, so pilgrims could do their prayerful walk to holy places. And of course, I've already mentioned the restoration of Iona. Chroniclers all agree that Queen Margaret was strong, pure, and noble in character. Her influence over her husband and through him over Scottish history, especially in the areas of ecclesiastical religion, was genuine and intense. She also, in her personal life, on a daily basis, attended to charitable works, serving orphans and the poor every day before she ate. The Queen of Scotland served orphans and the poor every day before she ate. She would also go out into the community and wash the feet of the poor as an imitation and as a witness of the way in which Christ served others. She rose at midnight every night to attend the liturgy. She was able to establish Benedictine orders in Scotland. She insisted on the restoration of many holy sites throughout Scotland and provided the means and the resources for those things to be done through her position as queen.
Oops.
So this is a picture of her husband, of Malcolm, greeting her. The love between the two was hugely significant. She had great influence on him as king, and he had great regard and wonder for her primarily because of her witness of faith, but also because she was literate. He, in his love for her, had her personal prayer book embellished, which in those days was very costly. It was a gift that he gave her for her to have that illuminated and embellished. So I'd like to share with you something, an excerpt from her biographer that gives another picture or a deeper glimpse of her faithfulness and acts of charity. And this is from The Life of Saint Margaret by Turgot. We need not wonder that Queen Margaret governed herself and her household wisely when we know that she herself acted always under the wisest of masters, the guidance of Holy Scripture. I myself had frequent opportunities of admiring in her how, even amidst the distractions of lawsuits, amidst the countless cares of state, she devoted herself with wonderful assiduity to the Word of God, journeying thus onwards towards the heavenly country in thought and word and deed. This devout and God-worthy queen called on others to accompany her in the undefiled way, so that they with her might attain true happiness. Thus it came to pass that when this venerable queen, who by God's help had been so desirous to cleanse the house from all filth and error, was found day by day worthier of becoming his temple, as the Holy Spirit shone even brighter in her heart, when she spoke with me about the salvation of the soul and the sweetness of the life which is eternal, every word she uttered was so filled with grace that the Holy Spirit, who truly dwelt within her breast, evidently spoke with her lips. So deep was her contrition that while she was talking, she seemed as if she could melt away in tears, so that my soul, pierced like her own, wept also. Of all living persons whom I know or have known, she was the most devoted to prayer and fasting, to works of mercy and almsgiving. Let me speak first of all about her prayerfulness. In church, no one was so silent and composed as she, no one so wrapped in prayer. Whilst she was in the house of God, she would never speak of worldly matters or do anything which savored the earth. She was there simply to pray, and in praying, to pour forth her tears. Only her body was then here below. Her spirit was near to God, for in the purity of her prayer, she sought nothing but God and the things which are God's. As to her fasting, I will say this alone, that the strictness of her abstinence brought upon her very severe infirmity. To these two excellent gifts of prayer and abstinence, she joined the gift of mercy. What, for what, could be more compassionate than her heart? Who could be more gentle than she towards those who were in need? Not only would she have given to the poor all that she possessed, but if she could have done so, she would have given her very self away. She was poorer than any of her paupers, for they, even when they had nothing, wished to have something, while her anxiety was all to strip herself of what she had. She was nearer to God, for in purity of prayer, she sought nothing but God. Clearly, he had high regard for this holy woman of prayer, who had great influence in his life, as he witnessed how she, in her faith and in her piety, had influence in the country in which she was queen. She was canonized and named in the Roman cult as the only queen, as the only saint in Scotland. Her feast day is November 16th, which was just last week. And you can clearly see from that glimpse into her life and her story, she was a woman of significance, power, and authority, and a woman of deep faith, and also a woman of deep intellect. That's a picture of St. Margaret's Chapel of Margaret in Edinburgh Castle. Jean Vanier. We're going to jump. We're going to leap decades and decades and decades. So we're going to jump from 1093 to present day. Jean Vanier still lives. Thanks be to God. We'll zoom forward to his birthday, September 10th, 1928. So before I jump into Vanier, I just need to check in the room. Who has either met Jean Vanier, heard Jean Vanier, or worked with L'Arche in any capacity? Wonderful. Is there anyone here who's been in community in a L'Arche community? Great. Okay, good. I may call on you in a moment when we get near the end to share a bit about that experience. That's great. Again, this has to be a high-level kind of sharing about his story, and I'm focusing in on one segment of his life, and because it shapes so significantly where he has, you know, the rest of his life, the rest of his 90 years. So a bit about his story and a bit about how he was shaped and formed and brought him to the one we know now. Vanier was born Canadian in 1928. He was the fourth of five children. And as you may know, some of this may be known to you, his father had a diplomatic career that took the family to France and England, where Jean spent most of his childhood. The Vanier family were a deeply faithful Roman Catholic family. And of course, his father, Georges Vanier, is known as Canada's Governor General here from 1959 to 1967. In 1942, Jean, or Jacques, as his Scottish nanny called him, made a case to his parents at the age of 13, that he should enter the Royal Navy College in Dartmouth in 1942. So y'all know what was going on in 1942. His parents consented to his presentation and argument and appeal that he apply to the Naval Academy. His father acknowledged when he was presenting this case, was able to acknowledge that he trusted his son and saw in him, coming to him at this young age, saw in him a leader. He saw in him a future that needed to be given opportunity. In the middle of the Second World War, the young man embarked on an 8-year career in both the British Navy and later in the Canadian Navy, an experience that had formed him for a lifetime. In 1950, Jean chose to leave the Canadian Navy, where he had awaiting before him a very promising naval career. He was a very good officer. He was respected by his peers. He was an extraordinary leader. He was a great athlete. He had all kinds of good reasons to stay. He had family history. There was, however, growing in him a yearning and a deepening stemming from his Christian faith. And the following years after leaving the Navy were years of searching, searching for meaning in his life, a deepening of his faith. And he reflected during those years on the ways he could live in the Gospels more fully in his daily life. So between 1950 and 1964, Jean spent time in what might be called a wandering phase, a searching and discernment phase. And I don't know about you, but that's a significant period of time. Between 1950 and 1964, that makes me feel okay about my children still trying to figure it out, okay? There is something about discernment that takes the time that it takes. Encouraged by his mother, well, by both of his parents, but mostly by his mother, he was introduced to a Dominican priest whom she respected very much and whom would come to have a profound influence on Jean's vocational and spiritual life, who would become for him a spiritual father, a friend, and in his words, a master. Father Thomas Philippe headed a center for theological and spiritual formation for lay people called Eau Vive, or Living Water. This center had many members from all over the world. Jean came to the center and joined the community and was deeply influenced by the faithful witness, prayer, and spiritual direction of Père Thomas. This relationship with Father Thomas was pivotal and significant in his life. Father Thomas, as a priest and spiritual friend, nurtured Vanier and nurtured in him the seeds of his vocation and had a profound influence on his spiritual and vocational life and his life's work in developing L'Arche. Much like his biological father, Father Thomas saw in Vanier a greatness in mind, a greatness in spirit, and a tremendous greatness in leadership. Vanier saw in Father Thomas a living witness of the living Christ, a priest who had a great mind, and yet who was deeply humble, was profoundly devoted to his vows of being with the poor, of living out the gospel, and of sacrificial grace. Eventually, Father Thomas was called back to Rome, and he appointed Vanier as the head of the Living Water Center. That didn't go very well. Some folks had some troubles in the Roman Church with a lay leader at that point in history. So it got a bit rocky, and Vanier then began his doctoral studies. He began his doctoral studies with a philosophy in an area of focus on philosophy and the ethics of Aristotle, which, of course, he defended in 1962. At the end of his doctoral studies and his defense in 1963, he was reunited with Father Thomas, who had just been made chaplain of a community, and I want to get the pronunciation of this right, in Trolles-les-Brés in France. Father Thomas had been appointed to be in this community, And so Vanier went back to find him in this tiny little village. Valfleury was a small institution that welcomed about 30 men with intellectual disabilities. Now, it was also at this time he had a visit with his master, his spiritual friend, and got a chance to see the ministry that he was engaged in at that time. But then he came back to Toronto and taught at St. Michael's College for a term, and discovered while he was here teaching, in that short time, that he was an extraordinary teacher. Students flocked to his classes. He was very good at what he did. He was able to take his, at times, lofty and erudite subject matter, ethics and philosophy, and make it accessible and understandable to his students. However, when the term ended, he returned to Trosley and began to dive more deeply into learning about the situations of peoples with intellectual disabilities. Deeply influenced by the example of his mentor and master, Père Thomas, he visited the psychiatric hospital in a southern suburb in Paris, and there he found the living conditions appalling. The facilities were so atrocious, and the care of those who lived there was distressing beyond words. And I'd like to share with you an excerpt out of the biography by Catherine Spinks that describes some of this. You think everything is your choice, but it is not. Gradually, this is Vanier speaking, gradually there is a discovery of being chosen, of being shaped in order to be an instrument. At the time, Vanier knew only that he did not see teaching as something permanent. And though not exactly seeking what it was, he was still in a state of waiting. And some months later, on his next visit to France, he got from Père Thomas a gentle hint to the same question. Was there something special to be done among the people with handicaps? Encouraged by Father Thomas and by Dr. Pro, who was the psychiatrist who was exploring ways in which there might be another way to support and care for those with intellectual disabilities, Vanier went to see the person in charge of institutions for peoples with a handicap in the area, who confirmed what by this time was shaping itself into a resolve to do something. In the late spring of 1964, Vanier began visiting different centers for people with mental handicap. He was overwhelmed by what he found, especially in the asylum of Saint-Jean-de-Dieu-Jameau, south of Paris, where some 80 mentally handicapped men lived together in two dormitories. It was a chaotic atmosphere of violence and uproar. Solid concrete walls surrounded buildings constructed of cement blocks. The occupants had no work. They went round in circles all day long. From 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., there was an obligatory siesta and then a walk. One man, Danny, who lived all his life in a collar and spat at anyone who approached him. There was something terrifying about it, but at the same time, something difficult to touch, something profoundly of God. I have found the same thing in prisons and places for leprosy sufferers. That is a reflection that Jean would give later in his life. And he continues to say that in places of horror, there is a kind of presence of God, of peace and chaos. One is frightened and yet captivated. Gradually over time, the conviction that Jesus wanted him to do something concrete became more and more realized in his life. He quickly met two people. He met Raphael Simi and Philippe So, and was deeply touched by their distress and where they were living and the conditions in which they found themselves. He decided to buy a small house near Valfleury to welcome and live with his new companions. And this is a quote, and this is a word that is from a quote, my warning. They were not a couple of retards whom Jean welcomed, but were Raphael and Philippe. It was not an institution which he created, but a commitment he made to those two men whose cry for friendship had touched him. This personal commitment would prove to be extremely fertile. For all three, it was the beginning of a new life, radically different than anything they had known before. Thus it was, after some months of adjustment and guesswork, that a very human and extraordinary adventure began. Vanier recalls, essentially they wanted a friend. They were not very interested in my knowledge or my ability to do things, but rather they needed my heart and my being. Within a couple of years, other homes were born, and Vanier set out a call for people of goodwill to come and to help him. Young people began to join him from France, Canada, England, and Germany, who became assistants who made the choice to live with people with intellectual abilities. Assistants lived the same experience of the encounter that Jean did. What makes sense to young people and what anchors them in their daily reality of what became known as L'Arche, or the Ark, is the experience of community living which deeply affects their understanding of human beings and of disability. And as you may know, today, L'Arche is made up of 147 communities spread over 5 continents with over 5,000 members. There are always new projects being started in response to the needs of the people with intellectual disability, people so often and continuing in even this day to be vulnerable and too often rejected. But at its heart and at the heart of every L'Arche home is simply that. It is home, a place where people live together, sharing the celebrations of life, the simple dignity of friendship, of love, of faith, of healing, bringing grace and healing to that broken communion. And that's the piece in the reading this evening that talked about communion, but that this psychiatrist who was working with Father Thomas in this understanding that it was trying to heal the broken communion in the heart of the individual. That was the language the psychiatrist was beginning to use. Father Thomas and Dr. Pro used this as their founding focus in their ministry and work with those with intellectual disability. And it was done through companionship, through being together with others authentically, in simplicity. Of course, there's a faith and light community that is also connected to the L'Arche movement, and that is not necessarily housing and home, but it's the same principles of gathering folks together to develop community. And I'm just going to check my time. I'll skip that part, but it's really interesting too. So both of these holy persons had a heart for compassion and responding to those in need in their lives. And both did so in very different ways according to very different times. Yet in the context of their faith, at the point in history in which they lived or live, and with the means with which God had blessed them, they share some common themes. Each had a deep and has a deep prayer life. I'm going to use the present tense. I'm going to assume Margaret's with us. Each has a deep prayer life, a Roman Catholic faith, and a relationship with God, and especially with Jesus. Each of them are highly intelligent and considered intellectuals. They are both people by birth who have status. Maggie, of course, was royal, and a princess and a queen, but Vanier also was a person of status and was born into a family that had status, rank. And each of them used this for good. with one forsaking and leaving it behind in his choice in living in community and creating this little house with these two men to begin with that grew into the L'Arche movement. While St. Margaret, from her position in the social order, did not abuse her power, but let it influence her husband and those decisions that could be made at court, and use the resources and people of her commitments to follow Christ and to care for the poor in her midst. So these two lives hold us opportunity for questions about our own faith. So I'd like to move to that section. I've given you a kind of sort of picture of these two, and now what, well, you know, the classic, so what? What's that mean? Well, what does that mean for me? It's okay to ask that question. So these two point to us, as all the saints, if we spend time with them, they point to us some opportunities in our lives, some questions we might ask of ourselves. So the first question I pose to us is this. One question for us to ponder that the lives of these two pose for us. In my place, my circumstance, my setting, my position, how is my faith in Christ influencing my work in the world, informing my place in the world, my relationships? How does my social standing, rank, or position provide good for the gospel? Or to put it another way, back to the point at the beginning about influence, which I highlighted as I started, these two invite us in their witness and life to honestly assess our own status and power and ask ourselves prayerfully and poignantly how God is calling us to direct and to point the privilege that we have toward the good, toward the healing, toward the care of the poor, toward the healing of broken hearts, broken communion in the souls of those who are in our midst, in our neighborhood, in our church, and how those folks have often been pushed aside, forgotten. The second question I think that these two lives pose for us and may help us to be informed by is about the postures of helping. Margaret is described to be the helper of the poor, and Vanier is described to be the companion of the poor. And the two words that I'd like to focus on are for and with. When we think about helping others, there's often a posture of, I'm going to do something for you. From my position and status, I'm going to help you. As opposed to a different way of being in relationship, which is about with. I'm going to be with you where you are. And have a mutual relationship where not only might my presence be an influence in your life for good, but yours will certainly be one in mine. Charity, love in action, and love as presence with. It's about relationship. It's all about relationship. So a posture of helping, am I doing something for the poor, or am I doing something with the poor? Am I doing something for the broken, or am I doing something with the broken? How and from where my charity, my love, how is it being expressed? From where is it coming? What hinders my engagement with them, with the broken, with the other? Am I able to entertain the possibility that engagement with, instead of doing for, might deepen my knowing of God in the other? This connects deeply to what it is to be followers of the Royal One, the one who had equality with God but emptied himself and gave of himself, as we hear in Philippians 2. I use the word vulnerabled himself. I don't think that's a verb, but to make oneself vulnerable as Christ did. Even though he had equality with God, that was not something that he held over others or put forward as something to be grasped, but rather had it as something that he emptied himself so that he could be with us. Both Margaret and Vanier do that in each a different way, do that self-emptying, do that capacity to give of oneself in that way. The third thing that I think these two lives provoke us to do is to reflect on our definition of what it is to be poor and who are the poor. Both of them were deeply affected and influenced and called to respond to the poor in their midst. And so they hold for us a question that's very important because we pray for the poor and we care for the poor and we live with the poor. But what does poor mean to you? How do you define it? Are there differentials? When you talk about the poor, is it out there or is it deeply connected to in here? The other piece that the fourth thing that these two, I think, hold for us and remind us and encourage us and influence us in our faith life is that small actions have large consequence. And we forget that sometimes. The small things that we do have profound influence when they are done from simplicity, grace, and love. These two were influenced and had influence in their lives with others. Margaret through her simple reading of gospel stories to her husband, through her daily prayer and witness, through her keeping a piety practice that influenced her members of the court and her beloved. She put her prayer into action. She cared for the broken, the sick, the neglected, every day before she ate. Jean opened his heart to a home for two friends with no real resources, with absolutely no training or skills in this area, but with a vision of hope and healing, an example given to him by his master, his teacher, Father Thomas, and his master and his teacher, Jesus. So I think the question that they pose for us, if we are willing to ask it of ourselves, how are my acts of loving kindness, some small illustration of my faith with others influencing, and dare we consider inspiring another on their way? And you might not want to think about it too much, because then you'll get all involved in it. But realize that your small acts of loving kindness, rooted and grounded from your following Jesus on the way, has profound influence and impact. And finally, how do we provoke one another to do good by our life and example? And of course, that's coming straight out of Hebrews 10:24. Let us consider how we may spur, motivate, stir up, provoke one another on toward love and good deeds. As followers of the King, the Royal One of God, the Prince of Peace, who had equality with God but emptied himself, gave of himself, vulnerabled himself, we too are each in our own way, in our own place, called to have the same mind, the same heart, the same self-giving and emptying way, exactly where we are. That's the way to wholeness. Communion and union with God is found in this, with one another as Jesus chose to be with us. This God with, I have not come for you, I have come to be with you. So in sum, oh God, my timing's impeccable. I think we can learn some things about these two holy people and how they continue to have influence in our lives and in the world, and in how their vision and their faith has influenced change for good in God's world. Pray some more. Look for the good. Be inspired. Do what you can where you are with what God has given you. Live authentically and vulnerably, with vulnerability, and pray some more. I have a video of Vanya, but I think I'm going to close it there and refer it to if you want to. The top 10 things about being human at 90. They're fantastic. You may have seen it. It's 15 minutes long. It's long. So I may be able to put it up on a link to the talk on the website. Does that sound good? Thank you. I'm done.